Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We have reached the final episode in our series about the history of freedom with the writer and philosopher Leah Ippi. And today, Leah and I are talking about liberation movements, liberation from colonial rule, liberation for women, gay liberation, animal liberation, children's liberation. What links them all? How do they emancipate human beings? And what comes next? This episode of Past, Present, Future is sponsored by Faber Books. Faber, home to writers from T.S. Eliot and Sylvia Plath to Kazuo Ishiguro and Sally Rooney, has been publishing independently for nearly a century across poetry and fiction, but also politics, philosophy, biography, history, drama, and film. Specially for PPF listeners, Faber have collected together a selection of books by some of the great writers, thinkers, and essayists of the 20th and 21st centuries. Just go to faber.co.uk/PPF, and there you'll find titles including James Shapiro on Shakespeare, Tanya Branigan on the Cultural Revolution, Gary Young on American Crises, Catherine Rundell on John Donne, Milan Kundera on Central Europe, and Matthew Hollis on T.S. Eliot. Exclusively for listeners to PPF, Faber are offering 20% off all titles. Simply head to faber.co.uk/PPF and use the code podcast in the checkout. And while you're there, you can also become a Faber member. It's free to join, and Faber members get access to beautiful member editions, a live and online events program, articles, book discounts, and more. Leah, if I had to sum up the history of freedom over the last 100 years, this is how I would do it. And to begin with, you can push back on this. I think there are three broad trends at work here in the history of freedom over the 20th century, the early 21st century. The first is something that we've talked about, which is the story of liberation from extreme poverty. So over the last 100 years, it is one of the most remarkable features of human history, both in relative and absolute terms. The hundreds of millions, the billions of people who have been lifted out of extreme poverty. And not just the last 100 years, not even the last 50 years, the last 20 years. And that's not the whole of freedom, as we discussed. It may not even be the half of freedom, but it is a remarkable story. And it is one of the most distinctive features of the last 100 years of human history. The second would be the history of revolutionary movements over the last 100 years. So attempts to reinvent society on revolutionary principles, often originally through violence and then through philosophy or ideology. And you may disagree with me here. For the most part, I would say that is a story of failure. I don't think those societies have been reinvented in that way. The Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. The Chinese Revolution contributed many things to the story of emancipation from poverty. But the promise of the revolution, those ideals, have not been delivered. And there's been an awful lot of oppression along the way. And then the third thing is liberation movements. So over the last century, particularly in the second half of the 20th century and the early 21st, a different kind of story of emancipation of peoples from colonial oppression, of groups within society, minorities, but also majorities, women's liberation, liberation on the basis of sexuality, on the basis of color. And there the picture is mixed. I mean, some of these have been incredible success stories. Some of these have been disappointments. Those are the three stories of freedom. When I was thinking about this before we started this conversation, I had a feeling that you might say I've missed out the question of equality. And actually, that cuts across all of these stories. But before I ask you about liberation movements, do you want to tell me that that analysis is wrong?
Yes. So I think I have a tendency not to see these movements as either successes or failures. So I would say in each case, there is a history and there is a process, and that process has both elements of success and of failure. but I wouldn't qualify any of those movements as categorical successes or categorical failures, because sometimes they are successes in one part of the world, but us calling that a success comes at the price of neglecting what's happening in other parts of the world. And even when I think of the most obvious cases where we think gay liberation or women's liberation, I mean, it's true, but it's also true for geographically restricted areas. And there are entire areas of the globe that where those movements haven't actually achieved anything yet. And indeed, entire parts of the world there where they're not even in the social consciousness yet. And so maybe because I take a more global view, which isn't just focused on the liberal Western rich countries, that record seems to me much more ambiguous if you think of it in global terms. And likewise, with every revolution, I wouldn't single out, you know, the Russian revolution as being a failure or the Chinese revolution, because I think every revolution is made of moments where there are advancements in rights and moments where there is going back and regress. And I tend to think of that as generally being the case with every historical phenomenon. And so I'm a little bit more ambiguous, I guess, on both calling something a complete failure and calling something a complete success, because I think history maybe is a little bit more nuanced than that.
Yeah, I think I was calling them relative failures and relative successes, and also failures in their own terms. I wasn't trying to tell a universal history. And we'll come on to liberation movements in a minute, because I completely agree that, say, the story of gay liberation, you couldn't tell that as a global story by any means, or women's liberation. Post-colonial liberation we'll discuss, and you know that's by definition a non-Western story, but it has a complicated heritage. But those three broad trends, they're not universal and they're not the whole of anything. And it's not dialectical, what I've just told you. I haven't talked about the ways they interact. You know, liberation from poverty goes along with other things that push against human freedom, including rising global inequality. But nonetheless, I still think that you can detect patterns at work here. And one can talk about relative success and relative failure. And I think the relative successes and failures are not particularly ambiguous. Maybe I want to do more of a broad ledger of this. I mean, it's interesting that we have this argument, because at various other points in this series, you're the one who wants to tell a universal history, and I don't.
Yeah, but I think that's true, but maybe that's because I have also...
You want to tell a universal philosophical history.
Well, exactly, yeah. Which is, in many ways, it's not a consequentialist history. That's also, I guess, for what makes us different. I think you have a more consequentialist approach, and I have a more deontological approach to these things. And so it's sometimes when you tell a story of, okay, cost-benefit analysis, it's just not that methodologically what appeals to me.
Absolutely. I am aware that mine is a more consequentialist account. Let's focus then on liberation movements, because there are so many things we can say about this, not just in consequential terms, but in philosophical terms. But also, you can't lump these things together. Post-colonial liberation, women's liberation, liberation on the grounds of sexuality, these are very, very different things. And they operate on very different timeframes as well. If we start with post-colonial liberation movements, just tell me how you see that in terms of this broader kind of history of freedom that we've been talking about. So from the second half of the 20th century, one of the most fundamental shifts in human history over this period has been the end of the great European empires, not completely. And the emancipation is by no means a total story. But nonetheless, in Africa, in Asia, the creation of post-colonial states, that is, states that have been in some way or other liberated from the forms of rule under which they suffered for centuries. How do you see it now from the 21st century? I don't want to ask you whether that was a success story or a failure, but how do you see it in terms of human liberation?
But can I take it one step back? Because I am, as you know, from Albania, from the Balkans, and it's difficult for someone who comes from that part of Europe to be lumped under the kind of colonial Europe whose colonial past is resumed and summarized in the 20th century. Because as I see it, there were important anti-colonial movements going on in the 19th century in Eastern Europe and indeed in the former Ottoman Empire. And what's really interesting is that I think if you think of the kind of decolonization movements, anti-colonial movements, as being made of both those movements that emerged within the European continent and for example, resistance against the Habsburg Empire, against the Ottoman Empire, these were also, as the protagonists of those movements saw them, movements for national liberation and national emancipation, and they all took place in the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, the decolonial struggle takes place outside Europe. But I think with all the tensions of that 19th century, anti-colonial movement within Europe still being there, and indeed, I think accounting for much of what we're experiencing now in the 21st century, is still the legacy of, in Europe, these three empires collapsing, the Russian, the Habsburg, the Ottoman Empire, and the way in which they then, countries that emerge from that collapse, interact with Western Europe and what kind of broad European story we can tell. But I don't think we can tell the story of Europe and colonialism in Europe without considering this dimension of intra-European colonialism, which I think a lot of people tend to neglect because we think of colonialism as taking place outside Europe and outside in Africa and Asia and Latin America and so on.
If you do take that perspective, so you have the double movement in a way of the earlier European story and then the later more global story, one of the things that you described there was that European movement was for national self-determination of various kinds, particularly within Eastern Europe, and it produced all sorts of violent outcomes. One of the questions about post-colonial liberation is it or should it be a movement for national self-determination? And this is one of the arguments both in that earlier story and in the later story. The more radical version of post-colonial liberation is to be liberated from those structures too. This is not just about trying to recreate our own version of a Western European state or of a European state or of a modern state or of a representative democratic state with a national identity. It is to be liberated from that. The more radical post-colonial movements are liberation from all of it. Is part of the legacy of the European version, this is the crusade for national self-determination, that it's actually constraining.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what's really interesting and what happens historically is that nationalism, as we've discussed in a previous episode, not in this series, but when we were talking about democracy and nationalism, there was a moment in the 19th century where nationalism was an emancipatory phenomenon that was supposed to extend the rights to peoples that had been previously excluded. And in many ways, what made it emancipatory and radical politically was its resistance to the ancien regime. And so I think for that reason, because these were all in many ways, this was the world of the ancien regime, these were in many ways movement that in resisting the empire, the Habsburg or whatever, they were also resisting a certain way of understanding political authority. But that there hadn't been yet, I mean, we're telling the story in a slightly teleological way as though there is a uniform movement, but just for the sake of simplicity, there hadn't yet been an internal critique of even the liberal democratic states that were emerging from these 18th, 19th century revolutions of the kind that could then inspire an alternative way of thinking about anti-colonial movements as movements that also resisted the very structure of rights that was being given to them by these European centers. So I think what's really interesting and that kind of defines colonialism is there is these two parallel movements. On the one hand, it's yes, the movement for national self-determination, but also the awareness at some point historically, and I think this begins to be articulated by these Marxist movements in the early 20th century. I mean, this is all the big question of Marxism, socialism, and self-determination, and the debates between Lenin and Luxembourg, and are all about, well, isn't the nation state itself also constraining? Because the patterns of oppression are wider than the ones that are just replicated by the nation state. And so that's where then the question becomes, well, in that case, aren't we just replacing one bourgeoisie for another bourgeoisie, which was incidentally, and I don't think this starts just with the Third World or with the non-European countries, because someone like Rosa Luxemburg, for example, who was Polish, was using these very arguments to respond to the struggles for the national emancipation and the anti-colonial of emancipation of the Poles from the Russian Empire. And she was saying, well, you're just going to swap the Russian bourgeoisie with the Polish bourgeoisie, but ultimately it's still bourgeoisie and it's still constraining, and this is still not the kind of state that would represent a minority. And I think something like this argument then obviously becomes a part of other anti-colonial movements in the 20th century that are resisting British colonialism or French colonialism or colonialism perpetrated by the Western European powers.
I'm really nervous now because I don't want to use the language of failure or disappointment. But what you've just described sounds like a promise of the late 19th, particularly early 20th century, which has not been delivered. So another thing you could say, not in consequentialist terms, but just in terms of the ideas that dominate our world, is that...
And also, sorry to interrupt, just to point out something, just historically, also these things were going on in parallel. Just as you had these movements for national liberation within Europe, you had imperialism and the beginnings of the kind of so-called scramble for Africa and so on. So these were also historically more or less developing in parallel, which is, this, I think, what makes the protagonists of these movements also within Europe become aware of suddenly, okay, how are these European powers operating outside Europe? And then sometimes it's really interesting because often the anti-colonial movements within Europe are completely oblivious to what's going on with these colonial forces operating outside Europe. And sometimes because they have this narrative of civilization and rights and progress, which they internalize, they don't see how they become complicit in the perpetration of this discourse around civilizing missions and colonialism as liberation of primitive countries and or primitive peoples, rather, from their backwardness and their oppression, which was what made up the colonialism of 19th century. You know, think of even someone like John Stuart Mill or Tocqueville. These are usually progressive characters, but they're not entirely untouched by this rhetoric. And it's interesting how this rhetoric, I think, is reproduced also in the periphery, in sort of Eastern Europe. All the elites aren't really always critical of this discourse. They're partaking in it, even though they're partaking it as marginalized peoples themselves.
In a way, that was George Orwell's critique of imperialism, which is it's the oblivious form of politics. Unlike other kinds of politics, you can literally park the uncomfortable thoughts somewhere else. So it's not just that you export violence or you export certain kinds of exploitation. You also just export the difficult ideas, and then you can create at home a version of politics which allows a kind of emancipatory politics, which is oblivious to what underpins it. And one of the consequences of that is it does reinforce nationalism because it happens within national borders. And that's where it feels to me like what you have described is, in your terms, a disappointing story, that the promise of the earlier double movement of these anti-colonial campaigns has not been delivered, in the sense that nationalism over the last 100 years has not weakened its hold on the human political imagination to an extraordinary extent. And we have discussed this a bit before, but it's still a remarkable feature of 21st century politics, a global politics, a politics of collective risk, a politics of collective fate, that the idea of the nation is in many ways as strong as it's ever been in the relics of that world in Europe, but also in all of the parts of the world that have tried to emancipate themselves from it.
Yeah, and indeed, I think has become increasingly pernicious because it's often being weaponized and used as an excuse to then single out the world in deserving and undeserving nations, which is where a lot of the discourses that justify, well, these neocolonial measures taken in other parts of the world, or the way in which European centers often direct even third parties to do this with their economies or solve their debt in this way or create a rule of law and fight corruption, you know, all the usual rhetoric around what needs to be done to create functioning democracies, where you're very aware of a world that there aren't that many functioning democracies actually all over. But there's certainly a rhetoric of distinction between the nations that made it, that created a system of rights and benefits and welfare that works for everyone, and the nations that have failed. And then that becomes itself part of an internal justification that ends up excusing a lot of abuses in the name of exactly this world that is divided in this way, which is, I think, the product of this nationalist rhetoric taking hold.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What is the thing that's missing here? So someone like Frantz Fanon, a Marxist critic of imperialism and, you know, one of the heroes in many ways of the post-colonial, anti-colonial movement, argued that the great trap here was the one that you described, which is you fall back into the patterns of behavior from which you're trying to emancipate yourself, partly for reasons of class. The bourgeoisie and the city intellectuals will find themselves comfortable in a home which looks a bit like the thing that they're trying to get away from. Also for reasons of global power structures. And what's needed in the African context, he said, was a reimagining of the state so that we have to have something new, which he called an African state. He called it a pan-African state, but also it had to come from a completely different set of traditions. So this wasn't just straightforward Marxist revolutionary thought. This was also about culture and history. You could argue that in different parts of the world too, right? You know, you need a different imagining of the state in different places. It's remarkable the extent to which that hasn't happened.
Well, I mean, it's remarkable, but it's also unsurprising in a way, because I think part of the analysis and part of the diagnosis for why this hasn't happened had to do with the combination of the structures that the state offers to accommodate certain interests of certain elites and the political and economic processes that continue to be in motion and that make those structures be what they are. So in a way, I think the critique from someone like Fanon and so on was a critique of both the state and of capitalism and of the combination of these two elements, right? The fact that the liberal state sustains economic capitalist structure and that the economic capitalist structure is itself there and strengthens the hold of the liberal state, and to some extent also this asymmetry in the world between the states that made it and the states that haven't or that failed, is itself also the result of thinking about economic production and output in a certain way and distribution. And I share that diagnosis. I think there is something that's very, very powerful about the fact that there is here a dialectic of the means of emancipation, which is supposed to be the state, but also the fact that the state emerged as a result of these particular historical economic processes and not for arbitrary reasons. It's not arbitrary that we have a state that starts with private rights and then develops into public right and then develops into international right, but the bedrock, the foundation, is really private right. And that's in all the justifications of the state that you find in modern philosophy and modern political thought. That means that it's not as easy as it looks to separate these two elements, the form of rights and the types of interests and the claims that that right structure accommodates somehow, that these are two very hard to distinguish elements, which is where I think the radicality of some of that post-colonial critique comes, because what they're trying to do is to really think of a new form. And it's really hard to think of a new form that is not itself the result of the development of a certain political and economic process.
It's really hard, borderline impossible. I mean, but the history of the last 50 or 100 years, hard doesn't seem adequate to describe just how hard it is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reluctant to use the word impossible in politics, because I think politics is the realm of freedom in the end. Because, well, because I think, you know, human beings are, yes, they are the product of circumstance and there is the determinism, but there is also free will and there is also freedom. There is some element of possibility that opens up in ways that we don't always see and we can't always anticipate or expect, but it does happen and it has historically happened. So this is why I'm sort of reluctant to say it's impossible, because it seems to me that if you say it's impossible, then you're just delivering a verdict and it's like, you know, what Kant used to call prophetic history. You're just saying how things should be when in fact you're dealing with human beings that are also fundamentally free. And so it doesn't have to be that way. But I completely acknowledge the constraint. And indeed, I think a lot of anti-colonial politics, decolonial politics has discovered those constraints, and many liberation movements, actually, not just the anti-colonial movement.
And so in my three-way distinction between emancipation from poverty, revolutionary politics, and liberation movements, and I talked about them as though they were separate things, liberation movements have discovered the hard limits of liberation politics, because you are liberating yourself from something that you often end up recreating in another form. Revolutionary politics is meant to be radically different from that, because you don't just try and break free. You also, in the act of breaking free, entirely reinvent the system from which you're being emancipated. I'm guessing, therefore, what you're saying is the thing that has to be returned to is the promise of revolutionary politics, which is the thing that I described as the more absolute failure.
Yeah, but also a way of thinking about what a revolution is, which isn't working on one single axis. So often what you see in these revolutionary movements, including the anti-colonial ones, is that they prioritize one dimension of struggle. And then because that becomes the main dimension, all the others are neglected. And so then they are sacrificed in the altar of history, because you think, well, I need to make compromises. So where do I make compromises? Well, I decide which one is the kind of oppression that matters most to me. which is actually why I said at the beginning that I'm reluctant to go with this consequentialist logic, because it's exactly what forces you to go along these single measure dimensions. And if you have a different way of thinking about value, then you're less condemned to having to make these kinds of decisions where, you know, you have to decide, okay, which of these values is consequentially the most likely to make me succeed, or which ones am I willing to sacrifice more easily? And I think all of these revolutions, even when they're revolutionary movements, they somehow end up, I think, sacrificing because they decide, okay, I'm going to prioritize the economic struggle, or I'm going to prioritize the political struggle, or I'm going to prioritize the social or the cultural struggle, and I'll forget. And it's exactly what's really hard, but what's needed is to be able to maintain that intersectional dimension. If they are liberation movements, they have to be able to be functional and effective on all of these levels. And that's why I think it's both a challenge, but what needs to be kept in mind when assessing their successes and thinking about what could they do better next time.
Where then would women's liberation fit into that intersectional struggle? A critique that has often been made of a thinker, a writer like Fanon, is that he entirely neglected those aspects of the oppression of women by men that were part of the sort of history and, you know, social African version of politics that he was hoping to emancipate from the dead hand of the Western liberal representative state. And within the Western liberal representative state, women's emancipation in its own terms has been part of the progress of the last 50 or 100 years. So where do you place, I mean, it used to be called women's liberation. I don't think it is called that anymore. It was the women's liberation movement. I think it's now just called feminism. But where would you place women's liberation in the wider struggle?
Yeah, I think there is a similar dynamic at play. And one can really see the parallels here, both if you think, for example, about the, let's say, take the example of Black liberation in the 20th century and the authors that contributed to thinking about Black liberation, who were, a lot of them were Marxists, you know, Du Bois, Cedric Robinson, a number of people who engaged critically with the Marxist tradition by saying, look, the Marxist tradition itself inherits a number of biases and prejudices of this Enlightenment view of the world, and the kind of civilizational discourse that shaped a lot of that Enlightenment view of the world is also somehow an original sin in the thought of Marx himself, because he never really separated or never really gave a radical critique of that. And that was the problem with white Marxism, as it were. They were just not thinking about Black people as relevant oppressed subjects. They were thinking mainly about the working classes. But then when you were scratching the surface a little bit more, it turned out that the working classes were mainly white. And so the Black Marxists complained that, you know, this was not a liberation discourse that was sufficient for them, and that they needed to come up with something that was more attentive to Black liberation struggles. I think a parallel critique is, if you think about feminism, and at least the kinds of feminism that I'm more familiar with, which is socialist feminism, a similar critique was then being moved to the anti-colonial Black liberation movements from the radical feminists, who were saying, well, actually, you're only thinking about the emancipation in the public sphere and in the state, but you don't really even have the theoretical apparatus that enables you to see domestic oppression as an even more oppressive form than the oppression that goes on in the workplace or in the factories and so on, because they were saying the men are white working classes, or working classes are oppressed in the workplace, but when they go home, the men are masters, whereas the women are the ones that are paradigmatically oppressed, because they get oppressed both in the workplace and in the household. And so there isn't even a kind of respite from that. And so I think I'm sympathetic to that. And it speaks to this both importance of keeping all these dimensions together, but also why then you can look at these histories of liberation in a much more critical light, the more you open up to these different types of exclusion.
But what about those versions of feminism in the more Western setting, in the more domestic setting, that prioritize the domestic over the political? Because in a way, that's where a lot of the focus has been. And there is always a question in those kinds of movements, how radical does it need to be to achieve some of the goals of the movement? So if one of the goals of the movement of women's liberation is equality, equality understood as equality under the law, say, a sort of classic liberal idea, for many feminists, that is the goal. I understand from what you're saying, you think it's not enough. But nonetheless, if you look at the last 50 or 100 years, on that measure, the change has been dramatic.
Well, I mean, so again, I don't agree with that because I have a different diagnosis. I think that is just what you get if you only focus on middle-class women emancipation. If you're thinking about socioeconomic constraints on women's liberation, then you realize that the cost of someone like, say, me, who is a relatively privileged professional woman who can, you know, pay for a babysitter and be able to outsource childcare, is that there has to be availability from hundreds and thousands of migrant women who come and don't have the same rights and don't have the same opportunities. And you can perform your job because they are doing it, but not because there has been a real liberation. So I'd say, and this is where I would say my criticism comes from, which is it's not just about formal equality of rights. You have to think about what are the structural socioeconomic conditions under which you can make claims of equality between men and women in the public sphere, and understand that we are not in a world where these can be effectively distributed globally and where everyone can actually benefit. Indeed, the cost of some advancing and obtaining those rights and claiming them is that others will continue to be oppressed. And I don't think we can be blind to that. And I worry that a lot of liberal feminism that takes the kind of, you know, empowerment or role modeling or what all kinds of discourses around women emancipation, which I'm not sympathetic with. The reason I'm not sympathetic to them is because I think they tend to neglect this more socioeconomic aspects and the socioeconomic constraints.
Do you have any sympathy with the other kind of radical critique of liberal feminism, which is not the socioeconomic one, but the idea that these ideals like equality under the law, actually they are abstractions that are still structured to favor forms of male power. So you create equality under the law, but these are in social settings in which men are still dominant in ways that stand behind the system of law. So you still, you know, you find yourselves in law courts in which there is a formal equality. But if you understand the power structures that lie behind them, this is still a patriarchy. That would be how that critique would go. And in a way that therefore what is needed is not an emphasis on formal equality or abstract equality, but something more like separateness. So something more like the idea that groups that are oppressed shouldn't just be blended back into the great liberal egalitarian mix in which the people with power still have the power, they do it under the guise of the rule of law. But what you need is different kind of status. In an earlier episode, I said there is a liberal definition of the advance of freedom, which is from status to contract. So this radical critique would say, actually, we need to move back from contract to status in the sense that we need to recognize the status of the really oppressed groups. And they need not egalitarian under the rule of law protection, but special protection, special rights.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic, but I also with some qualifications. I have a different view here, which is I have a kind of transitional ideal and then a more overarching, more demanding ideal. I'm sympathetic to it. And I think the reasons I'm sympathetic are similar to what we discussed last time in one of our previous episodes when we were talking about Machiavelli and the importance of class-specific institutions and these group-differentiated representative institutions. I think something like that could be said for women's when I agree that there is a dimension of oppression which isn't reducible to just economic oppression. There is a dimension of oppression that we could call patriarchy, which has to do with symbols and role models and social norms and the way in which these are replicated historically. And for that, I think it would be important to actually create something like group-based representation that goes back to a different ideal of equality from the one that we are familiar with in liberal societies. On the other hand, I also really like the ideal of equality, the kind of the more general, the more abstract one, because there is something to be said for it, for being able to transition from one group to the other, and so for having flexibility in how you understand representation. And I worry that, yes, these are in the intermediate, perhaps the best we can do, and they are very important. But I think it's also important that these groups are not then reified and have such strong boundaries that they can never be crossed. And because I think there is a loss there, because no identity should ever be so understood in such a way that you can never cross from one way of understanding your identity to the other. And so I think the ideal shouldn't be this exclusive group representation, should be something different and a bit more flexible and a bit more fluid. But perhaps what we need right now, given the conditions, it is actually something like group-specific representation. And I'm sympathetic to that argument. And I can really see the force behind a lot of the claims.
So how would that work in practice, even if it's only transitional on the way to something that is closer to your ideal? But are we talking about women representing women?
Yeah. I mean, that, but also, you know, creating institutions where you have actually collective empowerment of women. So actually not just having voices in fora that are made by both men and women, but actually having institutions that are just women, and where you think about something like the Machiavellian example of class-specific institutions, but perhaps with the gender-specific element. So I don't really know. I'm thinking about it as I'm saying it. I've always thought about it, but I haven't thought about how you specifically you kind of turn it into institutions. But maybe there is something along those lines. I mean, Iris Marion Young had this discussion in Justice and the Politics of Difference, where she talked about group-specific representation and what that involved, and the kinds of assemblies that you would open up only to members of some groups and not others, and what legislative and executive measures you could take with one rather than the other type of representation. So there is a little bit of work done in that direction, and I'm sympathetic to that.
What about political parties? There are occasionally attempts to found political parties in systems where the most powerful parties are kind of catch-all parties that try to build coalitions where they match and trade off the interests of different groups in order to produce a general program. And there's often pushback against that with an attempt to found, say, a women's party or women's equality party or a women's liberation party to represent more specific interests. But they tend to founder. I mean, it's partly because of the structure of the electoral systems that we have. It's partly because of the way the institutions are set up. But nonetheless, there's always a strong appeal of the idea that you want to have a political party, which are the most powerful organizations in democratic political systems of the kind we have, that doesn't just try and balance and catch all and build the biggest coalition it has. It just does speak for the group.
Yeah, but one of the criticisms of the parties that we know in the circumstances that we have them, in which they have emerged and increasingly what they have become, is exactly that they are actually, they claim to speak for everyone, but in fact are most of the time captured by powerful elites who in the end control the agenda and decide what gets said and what doesn't get said and gets ruled out. So there is a criticism of parties for having this ideal of general universal representation, but actually in practice operating just like very small restricted interest groups. And what you'd need to do to open up the party system, to make it more inclusive, both along socioeconomic lines, but also now also along gender lines or ethnicity lines, is a very difficult question. I don't know that I have the answer up my sleeve, but I'm not hostile to thinking about ways in which you can actually create forms of group representation, which consolidate and strengthen the group and enable it to have even sometimes, you know, veto powers or have say on some things that are really important. And I wouldn't, if there are questions that, not because I necessarily think and automatically think that every decision that affects women should be taken just by women, but there is something to be said for also having the kinds of institutions that enable women to have more of a say on certain issues than, say, men.
So I want to ask you about gay liberation, because in my lifetime, it's one of the most dramatic social shifts. So when I was born in 1967, in March 1967 in the UK, homosexuality was still illegal. It was outlawed. So it was only decriminalized, I think, in the summer of 1967. So within my lifetime. When I was a student in the late 1980s in the UK, the social stigma was still really acute. And there was a lot of violence. Gay students would be beaten up regularly. It was sort of just part of the background of, you know, it's an unfortunate world we live in, but this kind of stuff happens. The government in the UK in the 1980s, the Thatcher government, was hostile to gay rights. And this percolated through to the way that people talked about it. That was also the era of the arrival of AIDS as a disease, which was, you know, treated in public discourse in the UK in a way that now seems like it comes from 100 years ago, not 30 years ago. And in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a really dramatic shift in terms of social acceptance and understanding, in terms of the way in which institutions, and I think even here of things like tabloid newspapers, it is unbelievable when you look back on how tabloid newspapers used to write about the lives of gay people, even 20 years ago compared to now. I can't think of a comparably dramatic shift in anything, actually, on any dimension. And yet, what's also interesting about it is the sort of flagship example of the change is the legalization in many, many places in the world, by no means all, as you said earlier, you know, I'm talking about certain parts of the world, but still it's remarkably widespread, actually, which is the acceptance and the legalization of gay marriage. But it's interesting that it's marriage, because then in that longer story of human history, marriage is one of the things that women in particular wanted to be emancipated from, because marriage has often been seen as the great constrainer of human freedom. I'm really curious to know what you think about that sort of double symbol of one really successful liberation movement, which is the gay rights movement. I'm going to use the language of success, even if you hate it. It has been incredibly successful in certain parts of the world. In other parts of the world, you can still lose your life for having the wrong sexuality. But you know, that was true in the part of the world I grew up in. I mean, it was true in Britain. But it's much less true today. It's not perfect, but it's much less true today. And yet, the symbol of this emancipation is marriage. How do you feel about that? I'm really curious to know, actually, how you feel about that.
Yeah, so I mean, what's interesting, I think, with just taking, again, going a little bit back historically, is that I don't think it was the case that there was gay oppression in all societies to the same extent always. So there have been periods in history where there was much more tolerance toward gay people. And indeed, I discovered the other day, while I was doing something unrelated researching the Ottoman Empire, I discovered that in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, in the Ottoman Empire, punishment against gay people was much, much less than it was in Victorian, and it's a later Victorian Britain. And indeed, you know, in England, you could be killed. And in the Ottoman Empire, you just had to have a fine. You paid a fine. And so there were moments where there was much more tolerance. And this is, for me, that was interesting, because you usually think of, you know, the Ottoman Empire as these horrible Muslims who just must have been really horrible towards everyone, and in particular towards gay people, if you think of the condition of gay people around the world now. But it turned out that there actually historically things were much more complicated. The other thing that I wanted to say also historically, for me, it's really interesting, because I think one of the reasons why the gay liberation movement has been so successful, in particular from, I don't know, 1990 onwards, is that I think the cause was taken up mostly by the left to begin with, and then it sort of took up at a moment where there seemed to be a vacuum in terms of what kind of causes the left would embrace when socialism was dead as an ideal for the future. And so it became this civil rights movement, I think, became particularly important and really came at the center of the agenda when it came to green parties, or broadly speaking, parties of the left in Western Europe, at the very moment where they somehow decided that there was nothing to be done with socioeconomic ideas of revolution or socialism in particular, and radical emancipation of that kind. And so then the struggle became one of opening up legal access and legal rights. And I think it coincides with, in the case of gay people, with exactly gay liberation, which was one of the benefits of having this moment in history, because they could become prominent and that they were, their cause was taken up by the left. It also, I think, goes back to human rights more generally. So you get this flourishing of discourse around human rights and the importance of human rights, because it seems to me that once you lose the vision of an emancipation through a different socio-political system, what you have is just emancipation through the law. And so the law then becomes the site of demands for progressive involvement of previously excluded groups. So I don't think it's a coincidence historically that this happened, that the gay movement takes this form. And you're right that it pushes against some of these other ideas of, isn't this the state? Is marriage is what feminists were rebelling against because of its oppressive nature? But then it depends on how you understand marriage and how you define it and how you think about it. It can be a very general, very abstract social structure that can then be filled with content depending on how the politics of it operates. And I think it's also really interesting that some of these tensions you see also between, say, trans movements now and feminists movements, where you sometimes see this kind of tension about, well, what does this movement want might be the opposite of what has been claimed in the past by this other one. So I think the tension is somehow part of the politics of it. And I don't have firm views on which one is right and which one is wrong. So I'm not going to give you an answer on which ones I like. So for me, it's more interesting sociologically to see, why did this happen, and why did emancipation through the law suddenly become the be-all and end-all of all progressive movements? Because I don't think they could see beyond the emancipation through the law, beyond the kind of politics of the present.
And in the history of feminism, it's not marriage, it's divorce is the great symbol. I mean, divorce was the great battle, right? In the French Revolution, all the way back to the French Revolution, the great battle was for emancipation through the right to end a marriage under conditions, but under conditions in which marriage was profoundly oppressive because particularly property was not equally distributed within the household. That's a 200-year plus old story.
Yeah, exactly, which I think also goes back to this idea that these aren't what looks like it's just a struggle for rights for just abstract political representation. In the end, also has an important material component behind it that does a lot of work in how you understand the struggle and how it develops and what constraints and what possibilities there are there.
So to finish then, and maybe I know what you're going to say, maybe I don't know what you're going to say. So in the 21st century, the 20th century, and the early 21st century, you can map the arc of liberation movements. For better and for worse, it's complicated. I do get it doesn't all move in one direction. It's not a global story. Advances in one place, even if the word is right, advance, see backward steps in other places. All of that is going on. But you can map the arc of these things. It is possible to talk about a period where post-colonial liberation movements come to a kind of fruition. The thing that I just described across my lifetime, from living in a society where to be gay was a crime, to a society in which gay marriage is accepted by people who 20 years ago would have railed against it. That is a direction of travel. When you look ahead, what is the liberation movement of the second half of the first half of the 21st century that might characterize it? Or what is the one that's missing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm going to be old-fashioned historical materialist about this. I don't think we can know about the movement without knowing what the tensions are on the ground. And as I understand, as I see the future, it seems to me that the battles around environmental questions and related to climate change will become increasingly important, and they will pose increasingly important constraints on the world that we have. And I think maybe from there, there'll be much more prominence given to animal rights movements or movements to do with conservation of nature that have to do with kind of rethinking our relationship to nature in a much more sustainable way. But on the other hand, I also don't think that any of these movements that we know now will go. So I think the working class movements will, work class claims will remain important, and women's claims will remain important, and all of these other discussions that we've had, it's not that as though they have a kind of shelf life and then they go and they get replaced by something else. They are there for as long as the conditions that enable them to be reproduced are in place. And so I think there will be a lot of what we have, and there may be new emerging movements that have to do with developed with the conditions, the changes in the economy and in society and culture more broadly, and where I think some of these environmental questions that I've just been discussing will fit. So maybe that will become much more central, as it already begins to, we can already begin to see.
Animal liberation, that's also a phrase that I associate with my childhood, actually. I mean, liberation was appended to these movements, women's lib. It was called women's lib. It sounds really quaint now. Gay liberation, animal liberation. The story of animal liberation doesn't follow the same arc. There have been successes, but it's nothing like the story that I just described in relation to gay rights, I don't think. Animals are still pretty oppressed, and not just in certain parts of the world. They're pretty oppressed everywhere. But it must also be possible that under conditions of environmental constraint, rather than the natural world acquiring rights and being brought into this kind of liberation language, just gets seen even more than it is now as a set of resources over which we are fighting. I mean, I feel much more pessimistic / I want to say realistic about what might happen over the next 20, 30, 40 years as the environmental crisis starts to bite, which is that human beings won't think, oh shit, we'd better take more care of animals than the natural world. They will think, God, we'd better make sure we use the stuff that's ours before other people get their hands on it, because this is all becoming more scarce. You know, as water becomes more scarce, as land, arable land becomes more scarce. I'm not sure I think that the result of that will be animal liberation.
Yeah, so I need to clarify something about myself here, because I don't think, unlike many of my colleagues, that either nature or animals have rights as such. I think there are claims that we can build around these as part of what it means to have a sustainable human life and human future. And I don't think that the claims of humans and the claims of nature are one is here and the other is here. And so to realize one, we need to sacrifice the other. I think this is a question that needs to be approached organically. And indeed, I forgot to mention children as part of my, you know, what could be the movement for the future? Because if we're thinking about future generations, I think it's really important to think about children and the claims of children and how one can take care and ensure that they have robust forms of representation that doesn't make present generations sacrifice future generations. And perhaps children are one way of thinking about the claims of future generation, and the empowerment of children, I think, is one way of thinking about the claims of future generation. But this all to say that for me, it's not, I don't really see that necessarily as a trade-off. I think the question of how we can all as a species have a sustainable future means that all of these demands are bound up with each other, and that I don't think you can, conservation isn't conservation because of some abstract claim that one group of animals or species in nature has and that needs to impose itself on all the others. It's more that humans need to relate to nature in a way that makes their life together sustainable, and that enables them to kind of develop a relationship to nature that isn't just instrumental and isn't just the way it is now, which is destroyed for the sake of profit. Of course, that's a political question. So we can't tell which one prevails, which one wins, which one loses. It may well be that these are all abstract, ideal claims, and that in the end, reality on the ground is much harder hitting. And then people decide to take the shortcut and to actually sacrifice animals and to fight over resources in this way. I don't think that's particularly enlightened, which is where I think that's why it's a political question in the end, because it's all about how you make the case and how you build it and what kind of arguments you mobilize in support of it. But I don't think it can be, in the end, settled either way. So yes, there is a pessimistic story, which is the one that you've described, where people rally for the small few resources that they are, and it becomes a kind of war of all against all. Or it can be that they take a much more enlightened long-term look, and they understand that these things can't go on forever like this, and that you will confront the question either way, especially with climate change and environmental constraints. And so that we really need to rethink our relationship to nature. But I really want to insist, I mean, I'm a Kantian, and sometimes I get in trouble because of this. It's not because of nature, it's because it's one. There's not nature there and humans there. These two are connected, and we need to really take an organic approach.
On children, I'm conflicted because I have for a few years now advocated enfranchising children. And when I say this in public, it's thought to be some kind of really radical, almost children's liberationist movement. Whereas I'm not that kind of person, and I'm not that sort of kind of advocate. I don't think I'm radical about anything. I think of it as a very pragmatic thing. I mean, for me, it's an argument in favor of small changes to democracy to try and see, you know, what might work. I'm interested in institutions. I want to try different things and so on. And it seems to me that enfranchising children is not children's liberation. You know, people sort of think that if you gave children the vote, you know, suddenly children would rule the world, which is complete nonsense. It's just the damn vote.
I mean, I'm not sure, because I sometimes think I'm very sympathetic to that view, because I don't think that the world that is ruled by children is necessarily going to be a much worse world than the one that we have. So I think there's...
Right. So this is where we differ. It's sort of weird. The one thing that I say in public that's thought to be wild and radical is that children should vote. But I don't want children to rule the world. I would hate children to rule the world. I want to make small steps, incremental steps. I want to try new things. I just think that enfranchisement is not liberation, right? Women's enfranchisement was not women's liberation. African-American enfranchisement was not liberation, because it's just the vote. And the vote doesn't liberate anyone. It's a small building block of certain forms of emancipation. But we're way too preoccupied with voting as the vehicle to emancipation for some of the reasons we just talked about. It, you know, it's the same people still end up representing you. And so when I advocate children voting, I'm not advocating a world run by children. And so somehow I find myself, you know, on the one thing that I'm thought to be radical about, I'm just as small C conservative as I am about everything else. Whereas you actually want children to rule the world. That's why you are kind of out there.
Being outflanked. I've been reading with my children recently, actually, Pippi Longstocking. And it's such an amazing book because it really gives you an image of what would be a world that where children actually rule. And when you read it, you realize, I mean, she's a kind of anarchist character. And I really like that aspect of it. But there's this kind of irreverence to authority. But there is also a kind of solidity to her becoming a master of herself. You know, she rules herself. She governs herself. She doesn't do stupid things. She's a very sensible child, even though she's just by herself and she's kind of controlling herself. And I mean, I never thought about how that could be a utopia for the future. But when I was reading the book with my children, I was thinking, yeah, I mean, she's a very sensible person. And so I don't really see what's wrong with a world in which, I'm not saying someone like Pippi and her friends rule, but where there is much more scope for that constituency making decisions, just as we make space and for a lot of other. I think there's a lot of stupid people are there that are grown up and make stupid decisions, and that indeed having a more childlike view on the world much might be in some ways an improvement. So yeah.
So one of my sort of more memorable recent experiences was reading a book to my young nephew and niece, very young, sort of 4, 5, 6, 7 age. And it was a book which was sort of just a general children's guide to politics. They wanted me to read it to them as they were going to sleep, sort of partly as a joke. And we were reading this book. And in this book, which is written for children, the author said, there's this Cambridge professor who's kind of so crazy that he thinks that children should vote. And the children laughed at this, you know, who is that crazy professor? And it was me. So, you know, like, if you ask the children, you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, no, of course you don't. But you often get much more sensible things than you get from grown-ups. So I'm not at all unsympathetic to that argument, on the contrary.
If you sign up now to PPF Plus, you will get ad-free listening and also the bonus episodes that accompany this and our future series. Just go to ppfideas.com or click on the link that you'll find in the show description. Our next series, starting on Thursday, is a series of conversations I'm recording with different people about the history of bad ideas. The bad ideas that good people have sometimes believed in. And we're starting with the science writer and broadcaster Adam Rutherford, and he's going to be talking to me about the sometimes seductive but truly terrible idea, eugenics. To find out more about what's coming up on the History of Bad Ideas, just follow us on Twitter at PPF Ideas. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.